Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another Arsecast Extra. This week we've got Andrew Allen standing in for James, who's still on his paternity leave. Do you call it that? Good morning, Andrew.
I think you can call it that if you're paying him.
Well, yeah, yeah. I am.
Good. Fantastic. There we go. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go. Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. And yeah, I mean, it was pretty intense yesterday. 2-2 draw with Liverpool at Anfield. You were there. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of all that happened, give me your cliff notes on what it was like to be in the away end there yesterday. Started well, ended, I would say, a bit more arse-clenchingly than you might have liked.
Yeah, I mean, it was... if there was one word to sum it up, it would be stressful. It was from the moment the game started, you know, you just felt everything about you just tighten up a little bit. But, you know, to be honest, in the cold light of day this morning, I feel really proud of the team, actually. That's kind of where my head's at the moment. I mean, the atmosphere was amazing yesterday. The fans were incredible. I mean, I don't get to do many away games. It's been a long, long time since I've been to one. And the novelty of that experience, I guess, maybe carried me through the day. You know, there was a sense of expectation going into it that maybe I wouldn't have if I was sitting at home just waiting for it on the TV where the dread kicks in. You know, you've got other things going on and you can kind of distract yourself with beers and, you know, the atmosphere in the, I was going to say concourse. I mean, it's very hard to describe it as a concourse in the section of Anfield that you're given as away fans, because you are basically like cattle. I'll post a picture afterwards and show people what it was like. But I mean, you wouldn't actually transport cattle in those conditions. So I'm not surprised they're knocking that stand down. But it was a great atmosphere. And to be honest, for the first half an hour there, I mean, it was heaven. I don't know whether the TV caught the Arsenal away fans singing, and now you're going to believe us, we're going to win the league. But we went a bit early on that one. But that was probably the high point. And at that point, yeah, after that, it just became very, very, very tense. And to be honest, by the time we got out, I was quite happy to get away with the draw.
It's a weird one because, you know, when you're 2-0 up away from home at Anfield and you're playing that well, to not win is disappointing. When you're 2-1 up at Anfield, even though you're somewhat under the cosh, to concede such a late equaliser is also really disappointing. It's gutting not to have won that game yesterday. But I think you also have to acknowledge that when Liverpool miss a penalty, when Aaron Ramsdale makes an amazing save from Darwin Nunez, a brilliant save from Mo Salah, and an unbelievable save from Konate right at the death, you sort of have to acknowledge that maybe it's a game you also could easily have lost. As much as it is a game that you should have won, it's a game that you could easily have lost. And I sort of wonder how... Like, I fluctuated a little bit. You know, when the equalizer went in, I was like, oh, fuck it. Because we were so close to hanging on. And then Ramsdale makes those saves and you're like, Jesus, okay. You know, I'll take the point here. Get out of Dodge with a point, and I'm pretty happy with that. So it's just, it's hard to analyze games like that when so much happens and so much goes on. That your emotions are going from one point to another point to another point, and it takes a while to settle down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about Firmino's goal is that even though it happened late, so much happened afterwards that, you know, that sensation of conceding right at the death, that's really frustrating when that happens. Yeah. We've done that many, many times at Anfield, you know, conceded stupid goals deep into stoppage time. And on this occasion, so much happened afterwards for both sides, really, that, you know, you were kind of, there was such a tornado of action going on that it was so much to take in. I didn't feel disappointed because we conceded that late. I felt relieved that we didn't concede another one in the end.
Yeah. I mean, your point there about late goals at Anfield is, I'd forgotten, you know, because maybe I try not to think about those kinds of things. But down the years, you think about the night Arshavin scored the four goals, and was it Ben Ayoun who scored a late goal? I remember Joe Allen scoring a late goal. Neil Mellor. You know,
There was a 2-2, there was a 3-3.
Yeah.
I would love to see the stat about how many points Arsenal have dropped from a winning position at Anfield in the last, well, since the Premier League started.
Yeah.
Because I doubt there's anybody who's conceded quite so many points like that as we have there. I mean, they do have an ability to suck the ball into the back of the net. And I mean, honestly, when they scored on 87, and knowing that there was going to be injury time added on, I was like, shit, you know, they've actually scored relatively early for them here. You know, we're really at risk. So yeah, look, I mean, to get out, to be able to kind of not sit for 4 hours in a car all the way home feeling completely dejected was something to take, you know, heart from, really. You know, there was a relative level of, you know, we were upbeat in the car relatively, I think.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we'll come to this then, because we've got to go back to the start, and we've got to, you know, try and work our way through this chronologically if we can. The team selection decision Mikel Arteta had to make was which one of his front four was going to sit it out. I thought it would be Leandro Trossard. That turned out to be the case. You know, I don't know that anyone could really complain too much about that decision. Like I said, you could make a great case for any combination of those guys starting, which is a nice problem for us to have. You know, we haven't been in this position too often in recent years where you're going like, which really good player is going to have to sit this one out and might be a bit pissed off. But, you know, the opening to the game, I think you saw very quickly the intent that Arsenal came to Anfield with when Martinelli picked the ball up, ran at Trent, went past him. I think it came back for Xhaka. Xhaka had a shot, deflects out for a corner. I think that set the tone from an Arsenal perspective in terms of the performance and how we were going to play, you know, at a ground where there is this history, and a lot of that history has been quite painful for Arsenal, despite some of the incredible history we've had there in the past. We've paid the price for it down the years as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think Martinelli showed inside a minute why he was selected, and that was get him going at Trent Alexander-Arnold, you know. He was fantastic all day, Martinelli, but he really set the tone. And yeah, I mean, it was a solid start, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it settled the away fans' nerves, I would say, straight away, because you thought, okay, yeah, we're on it. Because you sometimes, you know, you watch Arsenal away from home sometimes, and I say maybe not this season because we've been remarkably consistent this season, but in the past, you can kind of tell within about 2-3 minutes whether Arsenal are going to be on it or if they're going to have one of those annoying, sloppy days. But I felt like, yep, there we go. That's why Martinelli's been selected. Obviously, he'd scored against them really early in the home game. He scored against them a couple of times at the Kop End in the League Cup game a few years ago, didn't he? You know, Klopp's always kind of praising him and saying what a player he is. So I just felt like Martinelli loves stepping up to the occasion when it's Liverpool. And he certainly did that here. I mean, it really set the tone. I was, you know, very, very pleased.
It was Martinelli, of course, who opened the scoring. Little bit of good fortune, I guess, in the way that the ball rebounded. But Saka drove after Robertson slipped. Martinelli took it on, scored the goal, 1-0. I think we deserved the goal. There was another chance, wasn't there, for Jesus at the back post. Bukayo Saka put in a really good cross. Mm. It wasn't completely one-way traffic, though. I think that's something that maybe people have assumed in that opening 30 minutes when Arsenal were really, really good, that it was just one-way traffic. It wasn't, because there was a really good chance for Robertson at 1-1 where he dragged the shot wide of the post. I think Salah had a chance as well. But
yeah, I think Gakpo went over the bar even before we scored. You know, they were threatening. You know, there was definitely a sense of it being quite end to end.
Yeah, fairly even.
But having rewatched the match this morning, it was far more even in that first 25 minutes than I recalled it being. But, you know, obviously a goal and putting yourself one up and in a strong position like that kind of, you know, it sort of distorts how you're thinking of things. I mean, up to the goal, I don't think Saka, he maybe touched the ball once, whereas Martinelli had had the ball constantly. So yeah. I thought that was kind of interesting. But the moment we got it to him, there was suddenly this, like, Liverpool were on the back foot. And I mean, yes, there was a slight moment of luck when the ball kind of falls to Martinelli. But I looked at it this morning. We put 14 passes together before the ball ended up in the back of the net and had the ball for about 45 seconds, slowing the ball down. Holding had it a few times. There was a sense of composure there, which was a real mature thing for us to be showing, you know, at that stage in the game, I thought.
Second goal, I mean, it looks so simple. And I think if Arsenal concede that goal, we would be having a conniption about the defending, because it's obvious what Xhaka is going to do, playing the ball over the top for Martinelli. Martinelli runs down the line, cuts back inside. Van Dijk, I don't know where he is. I don't know what he's doing. Gabriel Jesus is basically on his own. The cross from Martinelli is perfect. The header is really good. Robertson can't get back in. And it's a lovely goal from an Arsenal perspective. But like I said, if that had happened up the other end, we would be having a fit about our right back, and we'd be having a fit about our like hugely experienced central defender letting the 5'9", 5'10" forward, you know, run off him or get off him and find that much space to head home from such close range.
Yeah, and I mean, in the build-up, it was actually started from a free kick, wasn't it? Because I think Martinelli had been, or someone had been fouled, and Martinelli actually sort of started charging away. And actually, in the away end, we were furious because Tierney had blown up too early. And
didn't play, you know, advantage,
Martinelli,
yeah.
Martinelli was making headway. But still, it's like Liverpool didn't really regroup from that. And it was what? Zinchenko to Partey to Xhaka, Xhaka to Martinelli. No challenges at that point. Touch inside. Great run by Jesus. I will say that before the game, I was asked for a prediction, and I correctly predicted that Jesus would score a header. I'd envisaged this kind of exact moment where he kind of rose at the back post. And you have that kind of moment when you're celebrating, where you're sort of telling people you've never met that I told you, but obviously I'd not told these people that he was going to score. That was incredible. Cause at that point you're just thinking, Jesus, like if we could, you know, we're 75% of the way there, we get another goal now, you know, this is it. We're on our way. But yeah, I mean, obviously Liverpool came back into the game. That wasn't hugely surprising. But I don't know that it was necessarily down to some of the criticism that's been, you know, targeted at one particular player.
Yeah.
But I'm sure we'll come on to that.
Well, we're on it, basically, because, you know, after we scored that goal, I think you could see Liverpool's frustration. There was a foul by Van Dijk on Jesus, fairly cynical kick in the knee. Rather than make an actual tackle, he took the player out. They had that chance from Salah. I think it was a misplaced pass from Holding that allowed that to happen, but he didn't make the most of it. I think Gabriel had done, did really well against Salah for the most part. But then we have this moment where on Sky, the minute it happened, they were talking about Granit Xhaka igniting the Liverpool crowd. Before I give you my thoughts on it, I mean, what did you think of it while you were there in the ground? Did you notice a significant uptick in the Liverpool crowd? Because on Sky, but there was a guy sitting close to one of the microphones. I don't know if you picked it up on the rewatch that you got, but there was a guy sitting close to the microphones and, you know, spent most of that first half calling his own players knobheads. Get fucking home, you knobhead. Was that the moment they stopped calling their own players knobheads and got behind the team, or how do you view it?
I sense they got to a point where, having gone 2-0 down, the crowd went from being kind of slightly shell-shocked to being restless. And there was actually a moment a couple of minutes before when Saka kicked the ball away where they all screamed for a booking for Saka. And it was at that point, I think, that you sensed that maybe they were sort of going to play more of a part in it. When the Xhaka incident happened, I mean, one, it was all the way down the other end, so you couldn't quite tell exactly what had happened. But there was a sense of, in the crowd, oh, Xhaka, don't get involved. We don't need to get involved. But rewatching it, you kind of see that, one, he's taken a bit of a challenge from behind from Konate.
It's a foul.
And then obviously he's yeah, exactly. It's a foul. And he's had a little nibble at Trent in, you know, frustration, I guess. But obviously what we didn't see at the other end was that there was a reaction from Alexander-Arnold, which in any other circumstances, in its own right, was a, you know, that was what caused it, the flashpoint.
Mm. Yeah, he pushed Xhaka in the back. You know, and look, ideally you don't want Xhaka to get involved there. Ideally. But, you know, football is a game that's fairly emotional. And Xhaka, as we know, is a guy who is fairly emotional. I just don't think that two yellow cards is what got the crowd going there. I really don't. I've watched it again this morning. Would I prefer it didn't happen? Yes, but I think it's the goal. It's the goal that gets the crowd really behind the team because, you know, until then, I know they had their couple of chances that we talked about, but, you know, Arsenal were on top. Arsenal were playing really well. Arsenal were deservedly 2-0 up. And they reacted to the fact that, you know, 2-0 is a scoreline where one goal makes a hell of a difference. Just before halftime, they score a goal, which I think is A, sloppy from an Arsenal perspective, but B, slightly fortuitous from a Liverpool perspective, where, you know, that Henderson squirter could have gone, you know, one foot the other way and it doesn't get to Salah. You know, he miscues it right in front of goal. He's taking an attempt on goal. Our defending before that isn't brilliant. Ben White, you know, is out of position because he's caught high up the pitch. I don't think Odegaard and Partey communicate well enough about the run of Jota. And we allow the ball to come into the box. And for me, that's what really gets the crowd going. I think if we go in 2-0 up at halftime, nobody's talking about the Granit Xhaka incident beyond the fact that it's just a bit of handbags. And you see that kind of thing happen at football grounds and in football matches week in, week out, week in, week out. And, you know, I don't think, despite all the lionizing and everything else, that the Anfield crowd is so distinctly different from any other football crowd, any other set of fans, you know, at home, big game, big opposition. They're not magic. You know, Arsenal fans have made plenty of noise this season as well. You know, I think that whole thing is overplayed and overblown. And I think the reality is if we defend better, that's not a goal and that crowd is quiet going into halftime.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, everyone in the away end was praying that we got to halftime keeping the clean sheet intact. And I didn't, I mean, it's weird. I didn't, you know, I've been to Anfield a couple of times and on neither occasion have I felt like it gets so loud that it would be unbearable to play in, you know? Yeah, the goal, I mean, the goal was very frustrating. Watching it back, we had 9 players in the box and they had 5. And the only place the ball could have gone from Jota to Henderson, and then Henderson, as you say, was instinctive rather than measured. And then Salah just did what Salah does. You know, he was just on the spot to poke home, and it was a decent finish. But it was hugely, hugely frustrating. You could see that annoyance amongst the Arsenal players that they'd allowed that kind of clear-cut chance to end up developing. And yeah, I mean, the key thing at that point was just to maintain our heads and try and get through to half time. And I think you saw with Martinelli, like, he kind of took charge of the situation and on a couple of occasions had the ball at his feet and just tried to keep the ball, keep it under pressure, try and relieve, you know, any sense of additional momentum building for the home side. But obviously there was still, you know, still a chance for Liverpool. I think, was it Jota? Had an effort that Ramsdale kind of had to save. I mean, it's more of a cross that he was trying to parry away and Henderson hit it over. And then the whistle went and everyone was like, right, breathe for a bit.
Well, that's it. Apart from Andy Robertson and the, Andy Robertson and the assistant.
Hench lino.
I mean, he's a big dude, isn't he? He's a big guy. I mean, I think if he'd really put an elbow on Robertson, he'd be spark out because that guy is... That guy is just, yeah, he's massive. I
will hold my hands up and say that we didn't really have a clue what was going on there, aside from you could see the Liverpool fans the Liverpool players were angry about something, but we assumed it was to do with, you know, something Arsenal players had done or something, decision that hadn't gone their way in the game. You know, we didn't know.
Yeah. Roy Keane on Sky was very good. I'll just play this now, talking about it.
I mean, what's he going over to him for? And what's he complaining for? I said at half-time, Robertson, what a baby. What a big baby. Just get on with the game. Baby.
I love that you say, just get on with the game. I mean, the halftime whistle's gone. There's not even a game to get on with.
I know. It's such a weird one, you know? It'll be very interesting to see what happens with this. And, you know, Robertson got booked in that moment. He picked up a yellow card. So, at halftime, I'm thinking Mikel Arteta, you know, he's going to speak to his players. He's going to tell them, look, the temperature's risen because of their goal. They're going to provoke you. They're going to get the crowd going as much as they can. But at the same time, both fullbacks are on yellow cards. Van Dijk is on a yellow card. You know, if we can get into dangerous areas, if we can run at them, that's what I was hoping we would do in that second half, where, you know, we could take advantage of the fact that they are on yellow. You know, I know Ben White was on a yellow and Xhaka was obviously on a yellow. So you feel when it's your own players, it's a bit more precarious. But it didn't quite turn out that way in the second half, where we had the opportunity to stress them out in that sense. We didn't really get the wingers running at them or getting in behind them in the way that we would have liked. I think Arteta said on Sky afterwards, the first couple of minutes of the second half, he talked about how they had a reset. The first couple of minutes of the second half weren't bad. But then the game, I think the momentum anyway, swung in Liverpool's favour.
Yeah, I mean, it got quite physical. I felt like Konate was kind of at the centre of everything. You know, he got sort of temperatures rising again with a pretty heavy challenge on Xhaka.
Xhaka. He was allowed to do a lot that, you know, I don't want to make a great fuss about the referee. I know nobody is Paul Tierney's biggest fan. And I don't think there was anything hugely egregious in terms of the officiating. My sense was, as an Arsenal fan watching this, I felt like Liverpool were allowed make fouls that Arsenal weren't. The Konate on Xhaka, like I think if Xhaka goes in the way that Konate went in on Xhaka, it's possibly a second yellow card, because of the way the crowd would have reacted. I think it was a very home team friendly, in inverted commas, refereeing display from him, where, like, even the one that led to the Trent thing, I think if an Arsenal player makes that foul on a Liverpool player, it's a free kick. Mm. Whereas we didn't get those. And I think those were the things that maybe just raised the level a little bit.
Yeah, it wasn't kind of game-defining officiating decisions, no. But there was something that kind of went with the home side. Because Konate's challenge on Xhaka was almost exactly the same as the White one in the first half that earned White a booking. What I would also say is, given the nature of the challenge and the fact that Xhaka was quite hurt, for all of the allegations that he might have lost his head in the first half, he certainly did not lose his head in the second half. You know, mm-hmm. He kept his cool there. I know he was injured. He needed a bit of treatment. But, you know, he kept his cool. So in that respect, whatever message had been passed to him at halftime sunk in pretty well.
Sure.
So, you know, yes, the temperatures were rising. I think Liverpool were deliberately trying to get it a bit more physical. And then, what was it, a couple of minutes later, very sort of out of nothing, really, penalty decision. Even from where we were at our end, it just looked clumsy and like it was always going to be given.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's soft, and I think there's no worse player to be up against in that situation than Jota, because he can make any little bit of contact look like it. I mean, my rule of thumb, of course, is like, what happens if that's Jesus up the other end? Do I want the penalty? I think yes. I do. It's slightly clumsy from Rob Holding. Jota makes the most of it, of course. But Salah put it wide. I mean, what a I mean, the idea of them making it 2-2 in after 51 minutes in the context of what happens, you know, after that is, you know, I'm glad that didn't happen, because as stressful as it was, the way it was, it would have been even more so that, you know, had he scored that penalty.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one, isn't it? Because you kind of think, well, okay, at 2-2, would we have reset and decided, hell, we just need to go for it again? Or would we have just been so under the cosh and got battered and ended up losing 5-2 or something? I mean, obviously, huge relief that Salah missed. It looked like he'd hit the post from where we were, but then, you know, you saw on the replay and it was, you know, straight wide. I say saw on the replay when I got home, because yes, obviously Liverpool still don't have any big screens at their place, which is kind of mad, because, you know, in the 21st century, how do you not have those? But yeah, but after that, I thought after the penalty, we had a period where we settled. Liverpool lost a little bit of steam.
Mm.
We took the sting out of things. We were happy to slow it down. It was a bit scrappy. It was very in the midfield. It didn't feel stretched, which it had done at periods before that. You know, and there, yeah, I mean, there were a couple of little warning signs, I might say. I mean, there was one point when Zinchenko was dispossessed by Trent Alexander-Arnold, which seemed to be, in my eyes, the first sign of some sense of tiredness on the part of the Ukrainian, because they were really targeting that right-hand side.
Yeah. I mean, Lewis Ambrose posted this after the game, where between the 57th and the 81st minute, Liverpool did not have a single attempt on goal, even though they were, I guess you would say, dominant, certainly in terms of possession and certainly in terms of territory. They weren't really threatening. And, you know, I'm loath to criticize Mikel Arteta this season, because I don't think he has made too many mistakes. You're not top of the table. And let's remember, we're still 6 points clear at the top of the table, despite how disappointing it felt yesterday. You know, you don't get to that position and make a lot of mistakes. But I think yesterday, the substitutions were not good. I think Tierney should have come on for Zinchenko a little bit earlier than he did. You know, which isn't to say that Liverpool wouldn't have found another way through, but when Zinchenko gets nutmegged and the cross comes in for the equaliser, you know, you could see on the bench afterwards, he's sitting there absolutely gutted that happened to him and the goal came from it. But I think that's a change he could have made earlier. I think a little more faith in Kieran Tierney in that situation would have been good. But Jakub Kivior on for Martin Odegaard really did not work. Like, I get the idea of, okay, we're in the last 10 minutes. Liverpool are going to...
Rob Holding.
Yeah. But you don't... You've already put Rob Holding on. And the thing about Rob Holding is, you know, people have their opinions about him. I think where he is probably at his best is as a backs-to-the-wall defender in situations almost exactly like this, where you're camped deep in your own half and you need someone to just defend and head the ball away. I think he made, was it nine clearances?
Nine clearances. Yeah.
So in that context, go on, sorry.
No, I was going to say Gabriel made seven, but I mean, that period, that 22-minute period before Kivior came on, there was a lot of balls into the box where they was just like meat and drink. They'll just head it away. You know, that's fine. I mean, obviously it didn't relieve pressure that much, but it was away. You know?
Exactly. And this is where I think, you know, if William Saliba and Gabriel start that game, you could probably make a rock solid case that Rob Holding coming on in that circumstance, because he is, you know, that kind of a defender, and he's also got a load of Premier League experience, right? He's, you know, been around the block plenty. He's 26, 27 years of age. You know, no, he's not a starter, but he's done this job for us countless times. Kivior has only arrived, still settling into England. I'm not sure he's that kind of a defender anyway. My guess is, I don't really know because I haven't seen a great deal of him, but he's a bit more of a ball-playing defender than a sort of classic stopper, right? So to put him on for only a second Premier League appearance when Anfield is like, you know, it's intense. This was an intense game. Even if Liverpool didn't have the chances, it was a very intense game. He put Kivior on, took Odegaard off. It meant we conceded the midfield, basically, to Liverpool, who brought Thiago on, who's a really smart player, who found some passes that other midfielders in that Liverpool team were not able to find. Kiwior's first involvement is to come for a high ball, completely misses it, miskicks, goes through to Darwin Nunez, who's through on goal, potentially 2-2. Ramsdale makes an amazing save. And as much as Martinelli driving at Trent in the first minute set the tone for that first half, I think this kind of set the tone for the final 10, 15 minutes of this game, including injury time. No chances, no attempts on goal for Liverpool before that. 5 attempts after that. I think if you ask Mikel Arteta if he could have a go again on that, it's not the change he would have made.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the message when he sent on Kiwior was, in the first minute, I want you to go charging through the midfield and try and put yourself about a bit and see what happens. You know, that was not the message, but that's exactly what he did. I mean, what they had two efforts inside a minute of him coming on. Salah went into the side netting as well as the
net. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I think everyone was a bit shocked about that decision because you just assumed that Tierney would be the guy to come on and shore up that left side where they were obviously targeting things, rather than bring on another guy into the middle who would then, you know, unless it was a case of I want Gabriel to support Zinchenko more and therefore I'm going to put Kiwior inside him so that Gabriel can do a bit more kind of pushing closer to players and maybe backing him up. But I mean, when you actually look at the goal, that when that happens, Gabriel is way outside the box initially.
Yeah.
There's this really weird situation where, you know, obviously Trent Alexander-Arnold does Zinchenko all ways up, but in the build-up, Gabriel goes charging after Henderson, I think it is. And I don't think he would do that if he was one of two centre-backs. But weirdly, because there was an extra one in there, he sort of made that decision that I can afford to go and press a bit higher. And ultimately, even though he gets back into the box, he's nowhere near the danger area when the ball comes in. And Firmino is pretty much unmarked just to head into an empty net, isn't he?
Yeah, he's so annoying. The amount of goals that guy scored against us down the years.
11.
I mean, has any player scored more against us? I don't know.
Rooney and Kane.
Right, okay, what a triumvirate of fucking... anyway, look, it felt sort of inevitable, unfortunately. I mean, you see the reaction to the goal. Ben White just looks absolutely shattered. He just lies on the ground. Zinchenko then came off. I mean, it's just one of those, isn't it? It's, you know, if Zinchenko gets a nick on that ball, maybe we hold out, but... Yeah, I'm just watching it again.
Do you think Arteta was getting ready to bring Tierney on before that goal happened and that was the last straw?
I think so, because he came on really quickly, so he was ready. I do think he should have come on earlier, to be honest. And I don't think changing shape helped us at all. It helped Liverpool, you know, changing shape into that back five or three centre halves, whatever way you want to call it. I think Liverpool made the most of that, you know, because it told them what we were trying to do. Therefore, it told them what they needed to do as well. How do you try and exploit that? Get balls into the box. They do have good headers of the ball. They've got big guys, you know, Van Dijk, Nunez, Konate. These are big players. They've got players who can deliver really well from both sides, Trent and Robertson, you know, very good with their delivery and open play and from set pieces as well. So I think it's a mistake from Arteta. Like I said, he hasn't made too many of them this season. I think he's been really, really good. But this is one where, in his own analysis of the game, I think he will acknowledge that maybe that was one he got wrong. But
it's just such a big ask of Kiwior as well, you know, to go in raw, in that atmosphere for effective. I mean, not his debut, but you know, it felt like a debut in many respects because it was the first time in a pressure situation that he had to face.
I'm not being critical of Kiwior. I think it's, you know, it was. not quite throwing him to the wolves, but I would, like I said, I'd have been a lot more comfortable with that substitution if it had been Holding coming on to sit between Gabriel and Saliba. But we have to talk about Aaron Ramsdale. The save from Nunez is fantastic. The save from Salah is unbelievable as well, because it takes a deflection off Gabriel. And then the save from Konate. I mean, this passage of play, after the corner is cleared and Liverpool bring it back in, I'm going to play the comms off Sky. I know that nobody wants to hear Gary Neville noises, but I think they do. The reactions of both himself and Jamie Carragher kind of sum up what this, not even 30 seconds, was, because he makes the save and immediately Arsenal have an incredible chance to go and win the game. So here's the comms from Sky Sports.
Stand forward by Alexander Arnold, Darwin Nunez, Konate.
Oh, Aaron Ramsdale.
What? Oh, now Paul Tierney looking through players.
Salah
thinks it should be a penalty.
Oh, Arsenal could go and win it. Michael Thomas.
Oh, Bukayo Saka. If you want a matter of seconds to sum up a sensational football match, you've just seen it.
I mean, extraordinary, really, because the save he makes, maybe Konate should do better. You know, if you're a Liverpool fan, you're probably sitting here this morning going, Konate should be more decisive with that finish. But for Ramsdale to get across, you know, there's a slow-mo version where they sort of, you know, he's turned sideways, yeah, and he's stretching himself. It's an unbelievable save.
To be able to keep the ball out when all of your momentum is taking you backwards in that instance,
yeah,
was quite something. I mean, obviously, all we're seeing is this kind of blur of 22 players in front of us, and the ball is bouncing around and you're not quite sure what's happened and how it's happened. You're just desperately happy that Liverpool fans aren't, you know, celebrating a goal. And then, as you say, I mean, the ball comes up the other end and suddenly there's this sort of hush descends and you're like, oh,
yeah,
please just make that pass. And, I mean, yeah, Martinelli just, I think for the first time in the game, kind of slightly fluffed his lines, really.
Mm. I mean, what a moment. You know, in a season full of incredible moments and late drama from an Arsenal perspective, you know, we got it with the Ramsdale save, but we could have had a double helping. The cherry on top would have been Martinelli finding the right pass for Bukayo Saka and Saka to slot that ball home and make it 3-2. I know we're dreaming now because of, you know, the way it played out, but I mean, it is a, you know, there was a moment as well, you know, where between when Saka got booked, didn't he? He got booked for time wasting because he ambled over to take a corner. Gabriel has a header which goes straight at Alisson, like either side of him. You know, and he's usually really good from set pieces. Gabriel scored a lot of goals for us, so I'm not being critical, but I don't, you know, Liverpool don't come back from 3-1 down at that point.
No, I mean, there was. There was also a chance, wasn't there, when Saka turned Konate in the box and then tried the pullback to Trossard and kind of overhit the pass a little bit.
But yeah, and there was nobody actually.
There was no one else behind.
Yeah, where Ben White would have come in to put the ball home, yeah, like he did against Bournemouth and Leeds. You know, he's not there because of the formation that we're playing. That's another aspect to how that change potentially costs us. I mean, there were other chances. I think there was a brilliant Martinelli run as well, wasn't there, when he crossed it to the back post. It almost fell for Saka. You know, there were moments for Arsenal. It wasn't a case that we didn't have moments to extend our lead or go on and win this game. So this is why you have all these mixed emotions this morning, where you're sort of grateful for Ramsdale saving and then absolutely heartbroken that Martinelli couldn't find that pass.
Yeah. And also, I guess there's just, for me, having experienced Arsenal scoring such late goals before against Liverpool and still not winning games, there's also this sense that we might have scored and gone 3-1 up and still found a way, or even gone 3-2 up and found a way to concede another one. You know, who knows? I mean, the way Liverpool play against us sometimes, you know, you think back to that game at the Emirates where we won a penalty in something like the 102nd minute and still managed to draw 1-1 when
Abouye
gave away another penalty. And, you know, even after Arshavin had put us up 4-3 in the fourth. So, I mean, look, who knows what would have happened? All I would say was that, obviously, you recognised as the full-time whistle went that it had been an incredible game.
Mm.
For the neutral, for everyone, I mean, I know that Manchester City's WhatsApp group amongst the staff was very, very pleased with the draw. You know, who knows what they would have been like with a win, but they were very, very happy that Liverpool came back.
Mm.
I've got a little bit of inside knowledge there. So I don't know. It was just an incredible game. I'm glad it's over. You know, we don't have to worry about Liverpool now for a while again. We've got 8 more to go. I was very worried about this being a match that might really knock us off kilter, but I think there's enough to take from this game for us to feel confident about still doing something this season.
Yeah, I agree. I think we can recognise that we didn't play as well as we should have and didn't make the most of the fact that we went 2-0 up and didn't quite hang on at 2-1. You know, you can see all of those things. But Arteta's post-game interview, he was very upbeat on Sky. He was surprisingly cheery because I thought he, you know, obviously had been through the ringer like all of us. But he was really upbeat about what we did and how we did it. As he said, you know, nobody's come here and done that to Liverpool this season. And when you look at their results at home, you know, they've beaten Manchester City. They've beaten Newcastle. You know, they're a different team, at home than they are away. And Anfield is a place, and this fixture, I mean, I think you've said it, you know, the historical drama of this fixture is embedded into what happens whenever these two teams meet, regardless of who's in charge and who's playing. You know, there's just something to this fixture. So I think there are certainly positives that Arsenal can take away from this. A sense of regret, a sense of relief, all of those things are valid. I mean, we're going to do questions in part two, obviously, but the biggest question, the one that keeps being repeated and so many people have asked this morning is, you know, do you think it's 2 points dropped or a point gained? How do you view it in the cold light of day? Or is it, you know, is it too early to say, you know, it feels to me like a point at Anfield is never really a bad thing. If you'd said to, if I'd said to you at the start of the season, Andrew, I'm going to give you 4 points from the two Liverpool fixtures, you'd have taken that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
100%.
And I know that what happened and how it happens and the context of it, you know, really plays into how we feel about these things. But, you know, if you step back and you try and be a little bit objective about it, as difficult as that is, you know, I think you look at this and think, okay, we should have won. We definitely could have lost, but we've taken 4 points from Liverpool this season and in a title race, in a season where you're really fighting for the title, I think that's a pretty good return from opposition as difficult as this.
Yeah. And also, and it was, you just look at the gap being closed on Liverpool. I mean, obviously we know the gap is closed on Liverpool because there's a huge points gulf between the two sides, but let's say that Liverpool are probably not as bad as their league position is making out. They've been inconsistent and maybe they're trying to, you know, find a new way of playing under, you know, with some of the changes in their personnel. But 2 years ago, we were so far away from being anywhere near Liverpool's level.
Yeah.
Last year, they absolutely, you know, dicked all over us at Anfield. We fell apart in the second half. We didn't fall apart in quite the same way, and we might easily have won this game. I think some of the nature of the comments, people being slightly downbeat today, is maybe in the context of City winning quite easily against Southampton and having won a few games in a row quite easily and looking, you know, pretty good. But if you you know, played this Liverpool game at any other point in the season, maybe not right in the business end of the season, that point looks great.
Mm.
And right now, that is what I'm trying to take away from it. Also, the fact that I didn't have to sit in a car for 5 hours feeling absolutely miserable.
Well, yeah, that's the most important thing.
Exactly.
I mean, I think, you know, Ramsdale, when he spoke to Sky afterwards, was talking about how, you know, the message within the dressing room from the manager is one of positivity. And I think you have to have that. I think as fans, we're feeling it because we're on a knife edge. We know how crucial every single point could be. We know, you know, what's at stake. We know how difficult it's going to be. There's some tough games and you know, the sense that maybe you drop 2 points is very acute. I get that. But, you know, I was just glad we came away from this with something, because I think when you talk about the impact of a result on a team's psyche, if we'd lost that game yesterday, if we conceded another goal very late, if like that Konate chance had gone in, if that Salah chance had gone in, you know, I would have some real worries about what impact that might have on us, you know? And again, like I said, we're still 6 points clear. And let's remember that, you know, people are very quick to write us off. They've been quick to write us off this season. When we lost to Man City, they wrote us off straight away because City went top of the table and we responded. I think what they have to do is focus on what was positive about this performance, take that into the next game, you know, and just show what we're made of again. So, you know, a point could have been better, could easily have been worse. I think we have to just, again, compartmentalize this one and go again.
There was an interesting stat on the Arsenal website this morning, which I assume has come from Opta, which said that that is only the third time this season we've dropped points from a winning position. So away at Southampton and at home at Brentford were the other two. Yesterday was the first time this season we've dropped points from goals conceded in the final 10 minutes. So maybe there's a little bit of that kind of thrown into it, you know, the disappointment of a late goal, the fact that we've not been used to conceding, you know, points late on, that may well sort of play into it a little bit. Obviously, the context and the timing of the season as well. But yeah, look, time to stay positive. Title races aren't easy.
Well, that's it.
People haven't experienced them for a long, long time. And this is what they're like.
This is exactly what they're like. They're full of ups and downs and things that put you through through hell. You know, when you think about, even when you go back to 89, you know, the results that meant Arsenal had to go to Anfield to win 2-0. Was it a defeat against Derby?
And a draw with Wimbledon.
You know, so I don't really buy into any criticism of this team's mentality. You know, when you reel out those stats there about how we've won our points this season and how we've dropped points this season. And actually, you know, if you want to be really positive about it, when we really needed a big contribution from our goalkeeper, there he was. And, you know, maybe that's the positive we'll take from this. And when we look back at this in, you know, a few weeks' time, this could be a really, really, really valuable point. Let's hope so anyway.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right just to say well done to Ramsdale. He's been brilliant recently.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just this game. He's been making match-defining saves week in, week out recently. So good on him.
Mm.
Keep it up.
England's number one, who isn't the number one. But there you go. It'll come, I'm sure. Okay, let's take a little break here. We will come back with your questions and more in part two right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you've sent to us on Twitter at @AAllensport and at Arseblog, also on the Arseblog Discord chat server, which you get access to if you are an Arseblog member on Patreon. As you are the guest this week, Andrew, I will give you first question.
Oh, thank you very much. This one is from at Ziggy_Guna on Twitter, who says, one of the most significant changes Mikel Arteta has made at the club is Arsenal's massively increased use of the dark arts, which were on full display during yesterday's game. To what extent do you think this detracted from our focus on playing football?
I don't think it did. I don't really think it did. It was interesting. I texted my brother after the game, the Mug Smasher, and he's obviously in some Liverpool WhatsApp groups, and he was saying that there is, or was, among the Liverpool fans anyway, a sense that we were taking the mick a bit with some of the stuff that we did, with some of the, you know, time wasting. I think the Aaron Ramsdale getting something in his eye on 20 minutes in every game move is going to have to be adjusted somehow, because that's becoming it's becoming a bit obvious. It's like, oh, Ramsdale's down, physio comes on. I mean, that's the thing. The goalkeeper doesn't have to go off when he gets some treatment, right? So he goes down. Arteta immediately gets the players over. The players go over straight away. So stuff like this is obviously preordained, right?
Yeah.
But in general, I don't really have an issue with it, because everyone else does it. Everyone else tries to gain every little bit of advantage that they can get, whether it's by time wasting, whether it's by getting a free kick. You know, and I said already, I think there were free kicks that we should have had but did not get yesterday from the referee who gave similar things to Liverpool. So I've got no problem with us trying to manipulate games to our advantage, particularly big games, you know, against opposition like this. You can't win a title without being smart, without being a bit cute, you know. Take the sting out of it. Take, you know, get them frustrated, whatever it might be. I've got no problem with it whatsoever. But I don't think it's anything that detracts from the kind of football that we try and play.
Yeah, agreed. I, earlier in the week, watching the Newcastle game, I tweeted my frustration at Nick Pope going down and Eddie Howe immediately calling a team talk, and obviously it being a complete farce, and that this is the type of thing that Newcastle do every time.
Mm.
At which point, loads of Arsenal fans piped up and said, yeah, but we do that. And I said, I don't care that we do it. It's not, I don't care if we're cheating. That's fine. But I don't like seeing it when anyone else does it. And this was the perfect example of this game. I mean, Ramsdale went down on 20 minutes just after the Robertson miss.
Mm.
Gabriel went down on 33 minutes just after Salah miss.
I think he did block a shot with his head.
Well, that was the second half.
All right,
57 minutes.
Right.
There was Martinelli needed treatment after a kick from Konate. Jesus took treatment when he went down under another challenge from Konate. So there were I think five or six occasions where we had to have the medical team come on. Now, I think in some instances, yeah, absolutely, that was necessary. In others, I think it was a case of take the sting out of the game, 100%.
Mm.
In the first two that happened before they scored, I felt like that was a very clever thing for us to do, because it was very clear that we were aware that if Liverpool build up momentum, they become very difficult to deal with. So mm-hmm. I think it's been a smart thing. I don't think that we didn't play football as a consequence of focusing on trying to time waste yesterday. I just think we were very aware that a 90-minute game at Anfield feels like a very long 90 minutes, and why not try and compress the game down to, you know, as short a time as possible. We still played football. We still, you know, we were still attacking in those closing stages, even if we'd been under the cosh. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's an issue.
No, I don't either. I think, you know, we the best teams, the most successful teams, all have a bit of that to them. And it sort of stands out a bit more, because you go, well, actually, you're really good at football. Why are you doing this? But it's part of how you frustrate the opposition. It's part of how you control games. You know, being able to make the cynical foul, for example, as we saw Arteta talking to Man City players in the Man City all or nothing, you know, if it's on halfway, you know, make the foul. And he's talking to well-known hatchet men David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne and people like that, you know? So this is part of what Arteta is going to try and instill in this team, and we're going to see more of it going forward. But I think it's a separate thing from the kind of football that we try and play. We did touch on this a little bit, but Zachary Baker, who's at ZBakeman on Twitter, said, "Can you respect Anfield too much? There was a lot of talk about how that ground can swallow teams whole. Can it be ignored? Is it really that potent? For about 40 minutes, it seemed we had it under wraps."
I mean, we've gone to Anfield and we've absolutely freaked out from the first minute. And we did not do that this time. I think we were very, very well prepared to cope with what could be a hostile atmosphere. And instead, we took it to them and completely quietened the crowd. I think, obviously, they were coming off the back of a couple of bad results and they've not, you know, been themselves this season, so that played into them being a little bit quieter in the stands anyway. I don't know if you can respect it too much. I mean, I don't like that it's become mythologized, fabled, what have you. You know, there's a sort of narrative around it that panics other teams. I mean, Liverpool certainly don't complain that narrative exists. It's the type of thing that you would love Arsenal, you know, to have behind them. You know, this sense that any team goes to Arsenal and the crowd are going to get on top of you and make it really difficult and stuff. I wouldn't. I mean, it's an intangible, isn't it? You don't know for sure, so it's not something you can really worry about. And Arteta's very much a facts based kind of guy, isn't he?
He is, but he's also a feelings based guy. You know, you saw what he tried to do with the music going to Anfield last season. I think he recognizes that there is potentially a bit of a psychological block when it comes to Anfield. When you haven't won at a ground since 2012 and when you've been on the end of a few spankings, I think it does get into the psyche a little bit. So it's not so much about respecting it. I think it's about trying to break down these psychological obstacles that you have to contend with as a team. Like White Hart Lane is a perfect example of that, where, you know, we've struggled. This was the first time we'd won there since Thomas Rosicki scored in 2013. This season was the first time we'd gone and won there. So these things exist. And it's up to you as a team to demonstrate that you're capable of dealing with them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one, though, isn't it? Because this set of players playing together have not experienced and been damaged by those past results in the same way that you and I as supporters have experienced those results.
Sure.
So they don't go to these places and necessarily think, oh my God, Arsenal surrendered a 3-2 lead in, you know, 2015 when they should have seen out the game. You know, I carry that around with me. I'll always carry 4-0 up at Newcastle around with me. But yeah, it's a different one for the players. I think they, and I'm sure that the management is aware of that. I mean, they've definitely got psychologists and stuff on board and all the rest of it, but it's almost about how do you block out the noise so that you don't even know that these things are an issue.
Yeah.
Because if you talk about them and keep telling people that this is a thing that exists and it becomes an issue, it gets in your head. If the players are completely ignorant of the atmosphere at Anfield, then it's not something they have to necessarily cope with, I don't think. But I mean, I don't know. It's basically my answer. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Your question.
Let's have a look. So, okay. This is quite an interesting one. Martin Earl, who goes by @Guna_Poland on Twitter, said, "Your thoughts on no midweek game that might have given a distraction when we now have to wait until Sunday. Also, does it help us that West Ham United are in European action this week?"
I guess so, yeah. I mean, are they away?
No, I think they're at home. I think they're playing a Belgian side.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, they're kind of, their season kind of rests on, you know, some form of success in that competition / avoiding relegation.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's a two-pronged thing, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the, I'm just going to get the table up here. I mean, they're in 14th West Ham, but they're only 3 points away from the relegation zone. So I think when you're playing a team that's in that position, there's always going to be a difficulty because they are absolutely scrapping for their lives, and they will recognize how easily they could get sucked into it if, you know, a couple of teams below them get a few good results under their belt. So it'll be really tough. I suppose it is a benefit to us that they're playing on Thursday. You know,
and we might easily have been playing on Thursday.
Well, exactly.
We won that penalty shootout, being an away game at, I don't know, Juventus, I think it was, that we might in theory have drawn.
Oh, yeah.
And obviously Man City have to go to Bayern Munich this week as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is the benefit, I suppose, of exiting Europe, is that we have a full week, is that we have the ability to rest and recuperate and to, you know, get people, you know, fully recovered from the exertions of Anfield. And then we, you know, we've got to go away again. I know it's a London derby, it's not too far, but, you know, that is the benefit. We have to make the most of that advantage. You know, West Ham can't begin their preparations for Arsenal until Friday. We can begin our preparations for West Ham today or tomorrow or whenever that is. If the players have got a day off or something today, give them a rest and get them back in on Tuesday ready to go. I mean, we've all week to prepare for West Ham. So that is the advantage, and you would hope that that's something we can really make the most of. And hopefully
to put a bid in for Declan Rice.
Yeah,
probably.
Exactly.
Unsettling.
And hopefully Bayern Munich kick the fuck out of Manchester City in midweek. That would be...
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Well, except for the fact that we also want them to stay in the competition and have to play Real Madrid further down the line. So.
Well, of course. Of course. I didn't say I didn't want them to progress, but I do want them to, you know, pick up a number of significant injuries.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see. Okay, here is a question from the Discord from... I've got to put my glasses on, so I've got to increase the font size. Gautam Bhatia, who says, do you think yesterday's game revealed one of the few remaining shortcomings with respect to squad depth, the inability to change things up in a midfield that was getting overrun / bypassed a bit with the pursuit of Declan Rice / Caicedo? Is that one of the final pieces in the jigsaw for next season?
Yes. Yeah, I think we probably lacked the ability to bring on another holding midfielder who could have helped screen the defence alongside Partey.
I mean, we had Jorginho on the bench, but is this the kind of game where Jorginho's physical limitations, you just can't throw him into that? Like, if you'd given me Elneny yesterday, I think that might have been the kind of change, because he's got the energy to get around the pitch in a way that maybe Jorginho doesn't. I think Jorginho is best when you're on the ball, when you're dominating, when he can play the passes. You know, I don't think this was the right moment for him.
When I saw Jorginho warming up, I thought to myself, I don't want him on the pitch today. Because the game was going at 100 miles an hour. And as soon as he gets turned, you know, Chelsea fans will tell you he's useless. So I'm not saying that he would have necessarily been in that situation, but it wasn't the game that you want to bring him on. As, exactly as you say, if Elneny's there and you want someone who's going to go tearing around after people, trying to close them down, keep the pressure up and all the rest of it, yes. So I think there was definitely a weakness there. And I would also say, obviously, the fact that Holding was starting because Saliba was injured, and then Holding therefore wasn't on the bench to bring on, maybe is another sign that there was a depth issue there. Because I don't think that, you know, I love Rob Holding. I think he's very good at what Rob Holding does, but I don't think he is Gabriel Saliba standards. And I don't think that's a controversial thing to say. And I think at this point in a season, you know, would Arsenal have won with Saliba and Gabriel as the partnership yesterday instead? I'd have put an extra tenner on it, you know. So I think there are a couple of little issues, but that's fine. I mean, look, we know we're in the middle of a process, and we've done very well to build the squad that we've got. But there are definitely areas that can be tinkered with over the course of the next transfer window, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why they are targeting somebody like Rice. That's why they were after somebody like Caicedo, is you're looking to bring in signings who raise the level. You know, it's what we talked about with the Trossard decision. You know, you've got three fantastic forwards in Martinelli, Saka and Jesus, and then you add another one in Trossard, and it raises the level. And I think that's what we're going to have to look to do in the summer. So, you're never going to have the perfect squad. I don't think any team really has the 100%, like, if this guy's missing, we've got the perfect replacement for him. In this game state, we've always got the perfect substitute. There's always going to be a sense that, like, one more player or two more players, the classic, you're two players away from, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't think that exists, but I think when you are trying to build, you're looking to bring in players who are better than the ones that they are, you know, are coming in for. And I think that's what we will try and do this summer. And, you know, yesterday we've talked about the subs and how the subs weren't really effective. I suspect that the lack of that midfield option is why he decided to go with the back three. If we'd had a midfield option, I think he would have been much more inclined to put that on and keep the three in midfield rather than take Martin Odegaard off. So,
yeah, it's just occurred to me that in the home game, obviously we had Tomiyasu playing at left back, didn't we, that day against Salah, and obviously he's injured, and another option who can either play as a centre back or a full back and give you options to maybe move Ben White into the centre. You know, there's that. I think that injury there was one that's kind of shown itself up to be, you know, frustrating, especially at the same time as Saliba's.
For sure. I mean, Tomiyasu would have been maybe the perfect sub in the game yesterday. You know, as much as I would have liked to see Tierney come on, but Tomiyasu for Zinchenko on 70 minutes is another one. Or if you are putting on another defender, you know, Tomiyasu has got the experience of the Premier League that Kivior hasn't. So maybe it's a little more stable back there. But, you know, this is what it is. And this is the job that the manager and Edu and everyone else has got to do in the summer. So,
yeah. I've got another one. This one's from the Discord, from Greg Justum, I think it is. He says, not much being said by the media about the potential of a big points lead going to City. With us now playing twice before we play City and then playing once due to the FA Cup, we could actually be 9 points clear having played two games more than City. Do you think being 9 points clear will play a part in how that game goes or how we approach it and put City in a must-win situation?
I think City will be a bit more clinical, a bit more methodical than that. I don't think it will make them change their approach to the game. I think they play the way they play with a consistency that is just sort of inbuilt. This is what they do. This is how they do it. Doesn't matter if they're 9 points clear or if they're 9 points behind. I think this is the way that they will play. I do think it would be a very interesting psychological aspect, though, if we could get to that position to be 9 points clear. What it would probably do is produce a load of think pieces about how if Arsenal don't win the title from being 9 points clear, they're the biggest bottlers in history and blah, 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 like we saw a bit last week, some nonsense doing the rounds. You know, this idea that somehow if we don't win this league, we are absolute chumps, which of course is just fucking nonsense. You know, it would be disappointing, obviously, but it doesn't suggest that we are you know, a bunch of bottlers or anything like that. It's ridiculous.
It's kind of crazy, isn't it? But technically, the only thing now separating us from not winning the league is losing at City. You know, if we lose at City and they win all of their games, and even if we won all of our games, they would win the league on goal difference. Well, right?
It depends how many goals we score. You know.
Well, yeah, quite. But what I'm saying is that, you know, would it be a bottle job on Arsenal's part
to lose a league on goal difference?
To lose a league that was based on one game with Manchester City away from home, effectively, you know, which is what could end up being the difference between it all. I don't think Arsenal are going to bottle this league. I think they might lose it, but I don't think it will be a bottle job that really causes it, because
if you lose home and away to Man City, then maybe you have to hold your hands up and say they made the difference, or that was the difference in the key games. They came out on top, and therefore they might be the worthy champions, if you like. But I don't think it's bottling or anything.
No. I do think it will be really interesting if we can go to West Ham and get 3 points, and if we can then beat Southampton. I think from a supporter point of view, just knowing that there's a cushion there going into that game, even though it's a sort of false cushion, a false nine, if you will.
Mm.
It's, you know, that would... It would give me some comfort knowing we had some kind of gap. Because if it was, it's all or nothing on that game, and City kind of win it and they take over, you know, they go ahead of us on points as well, then... You know, we might as well just write it off there and then.
Mm.
But knowing that City would still have to kind of do something, I don't know. It's a tough one. I mean, I think the one thing that's clear is we need to make sure we win these next two games to give ourselves as much opportunity as possible.
Take some
pressure, whatever pressure that is, off.
Well, I mean, I think as fans, we're looking ahead and we're looking at like what the permutations might be. I think internally that focus will be West Ham. And nobody's thinking about anything other than West Ham and how to win that game and take all 3 points and then see where we are by the time we have to rock up and play at the Etihad. I mean, we do have some other questions here about Man City. Johnny B. AFC on the Discord said, simple one, do you feel more or less confident we'll win it after today? He said, for me, more. I think we'll get something at the Etihad.
I think I have to feel slightly less confident, because if we'd won yesterday, we would have had a bigger points advantage and that would have put us in a better situation.
Breathing room.
At the same time, do I take heart from the Liverpool performance and think that we can go to City? Yeah, I think we can get something at City, but yeah, I think we can get something at City. I don't really feel more or less confident. I just think one more game down, we know this is going to go right to the end. There's big games every week, it feels like. I mean, I still look at that Newcastle away game and have sort of nightmares about it, really.
Yeah.
Because of what happened last year. So I'm about the same.
Yeah, I think so too.
On the fence there.
Yeah, but I think if we can go to Anfield and get something, and if we can go to Anfield and play the way we played, you know, when we were good, those good aspects of our game, then I don't see any reason why we can't go to Manchester City and get something, you know? Mm. So, it'll be really difficult.
I don't like the idea of us going to the City and actually having to try and, like, you know, psychologically think you don't have to win, because, you know, I hate those games when you don't have to actually win the game to kind of get what you need out of it.
Yeah.
Because psychologically, you just end up on the back foot. You welcome pressure on, you sit really deep, and it's very hard to sort of switch out of that mode once you're into it. So in some respects, there needs to be some edge. We need to have to kind of go and, you know, win that game in a way. You know, I want us to be on the front foot for that game, exactly as we were at Anfield.
Gabriel on the Discord says, do you think the biggest difference between Arsenal and Man City is one of character and composure in high-pressure situations?
I mean, they've done it, I guess. So, you know, they've won the league before. They've experienced that. But... you know, I watched Manchester City absolutely cack their pants against Real Madrid in the Champions League semi-final, stoppage time, whatever it was, last season, when they fell apart. I mean, all teams feel pressure. But if you're a betting man, you'd probably put your money on City, because they've had more experience of doing this, and we're really coming into it, you know, cold.
Mm.
It's 19 years since we've had a title win, so... but at the same time, I mean, we've got a lot of title winners in our team, you know.
Yeah.
Tierney's won titles, Zinchenko's won titles, Jesus has won titles.
Xhaka.
You know, there are guys who, Xhaka, they've won things before. So I think there is experience there. So I wouldn't just completely write us off. And I think there's something also to be said for the fearlessness of youth. You know, Ramsdale's been playing up the fact that, you know, he's not really playing with pressure on his back, because he's experienced real pressure where jobs are on the line when your club's facing relegation. So, the swings and roundabouts. But, I'm not too concerned about that.
I mean, I think the biggest difference between Arsenal and Man City is, you know, the hundreds of millions of pounds in sponsorship deals, but you know,
it's the cheating, isn't it, Andrew? It's the cheating.
That's what I was trying to say. Yeah.
Oh dear. I've got another one from Twitter. So this is from Jakub Kopisinski. Apologies if I've, killed your name there. But at Bubble Chuck, he is. Is other teams' fans wanting City to win the league just their way of hoping no one really wins? City's and PSG's league titles can be written off. There shouldn't be any real way of competing. Our winning it would make them more frustrated with their own teams. I mean, that's kind of what we were just saying, isn't it?
You know, I can see the logic behind that. I can see why you could just go, well, Man City win it because that's what they do. That's what they've been set up to do. You know, the financial aspect of it. It's easy to compartmentalize that. And I understand that, you know. But I do, you know, without sort of wanting to come across in any way I don't know what the word is, but I do think it would be a fucking great thing for football and the Premier League if Arsenal were to win it. And I'm saying that as an Arsenal fan. Obviously, I'm invested in it. I'm biased. I want us to win for very selfish reasons because I want it for me and for you and for everybody listening to this. I want us to have that celebration. But as we get deeper and deeper into this era of nation-state-owned football clubs, oligarchs, and, you know, I say this, while we have a billionaire owner, I get it. But for Arsenal to be able to go and win it, and this is why I was glad to see Liverpool win it a couple of years ago, that something happened. They grew a team, they built a team, it became competitive, they won the league. You know, I think it's good for football that it isn't just a situation like in the Bundesliga where there's, you know, one team that's going to win the league and it's Bayern Munich because they've won it for the last 10 or 11 years. I know there's a bit of a title chase this season, but, you know, it's inevitable. It must be boring as fuck. Same in France. PSG going to win the league. Boring, boring, boring. You know, the only reason the Premier League has been in any way interesting in the last number of years is because Liverpool and Manchester City have been duking it out. Otherwise, it's just like, fuck, you know, Man City would walk away with it. And I think, you know, if Arsenal were to do it, it would show, you know, Liverpool, you can build a team and do it again. Manchester United, you know, not that I want them to win it, but, you know, they could do it. You know, they mentioned Newcastle on TV in this context yesterday, you know, ignoring the fact that it's not plucky little fucking Newcastle who are going to put together a team of fucking local Geordie boys to you know, cobble together a team that fights their way to the title in heroic style. You know, Newcastle are now a Man City. That is the reality. They haven't got to where Man City are, but they are a Man City, and they're going to be part of what we have to fight with. So I think it would be great if Arsenal could win the title. And like I said, for very obvious reasons, but also, you know, for, I was going to say the good of football, but I don't know if that's what it is, but it would just demonstrate that there is a way to compete with a team that has been set up in such a way and built in such a way that you can't compete, that you should not be able to compete with the likes of Man City because of the money that they have and the way that they've used that money.
Hmm. I mean, I think if City win it this year, it'd be three in a row. And I don't think a team's done that since United did it twice in the 90s, maybe, or early noughties. I can't remember exactly when they did it twice. But yeah, I mean, you don't want that trend to be set in stone, do you? The idea that one team just keeps winning it over and over. And look, there's plenty of other shit for City to win this season. So they can, you know, go off and put all their efforts and eggs into the Champions League basket.
Yeah, fuck off. And, yeah, exactly. Fuck off and win the Champions League, and we can all ignore it because we know what it is. No one's going to go, yeah, I'm gutted that Man City won the Champions League. It's just like, look, they bought a Champions League at last. Taking them fucking long enough, the cunts. Let me ask you this one from Ashley Moss, who's at Ashley Moss 4 on Twitter. He said, with the news coming out from David Ornstein this morning about Flo Balogun, where do you see his future? And if we sell him now, how much do you think he's worth? And the update from David this morning was, big call ahead for Arsenal on following Balogun. 21-year-old striker wants to be first choice next season, ideally at Arsenal, but not looking realistic. So a move appeals amid huge interest. 2 years left on his contract. No plans to renew or go on loan again.
Yeah, it's funny the sort of existential crisis we managed to sort of create for ourselves on a Monday morning,
yeah,
worrying about a goal-scoring youngster who's playing in France at the moment while we're going for a title run. Look, I think it's a difficult one, but they obviously renewed his contract and Nketiah's contract for a reason, and I've got no problem with them having a bit of a shootout in pre-season to see what happens next. I'd like to see him have a shot. But at the same time, I can see the benefits of selling a young player for a large amount of money. Then at the same time, I'm also looking at it and thinking, well, we're going to play in the Champions League next year. So there isn't the need to sell a young player in the same way that maybe we have needed that in the past. I would say that with Champions League football and maybe a bit more of a concerted effort in the cup competitions next season, there's plenty of room in a football squad for very good players to go and compete with each other. Nobody really complained about it when it was, you know, Bergkamp, Kanu, Henri, Wiltord, Suker, you know, like that's what championship winning and good teams have. They have lots of good quality players. I get that there's a slight difference in that Balogun's a young player and he hasn't yet had an opportunity, and how you get the best out of a young player when, how do you give them the minutes they need to thrive when he's basically played a full season of senior football elsewhere. We can't guarantee him that, but then you can't really guarantee that to anyone. So it's a really difficult one, but it's a good situation to be in for Arsenal. You know, worrying about having too many good players is one of those things. And if the worst thing that happens is we sell him when we get 40 million quid, I can live with that. And if he goes on to have a great career elsewhere, fair play to him.
I mean, I think the key thing here is that there are, you know, 2 years left on his contract, no plans to renew or go on loan again. So I think it's being put up to the club, like, give me a chance or let me go.
Yeah.
I think we definitely need more depth at centre forward. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we made the most of this brilliant season that he's having in France, sold him for a very significant amount of money because, you know, he's developed really well. And we use some of that money to bring in another centre forward. Maybe somebody with a slightly different kind of profile. I'm not saying he, Jesus, and Nketiah are all the same, because clearly they're not. They've all got their own attributes. But there's a similarity, I think, in terms of what they do and how they do it. Whereas maybe if you're Arsenal looking at the Champions League and thinking, right, we might need something a little bit different up front, a slightly different option. The way we were talking about midfield, you know, not necessarily having the right option to make that substitute yesterday, maybe they're looking at another kind of centre forward or another kind of forward for the summer. So look, I don't. He's a Haaland graduate. He's done so well on loan. It sounds like he wants to play regular first team football, and who can blame him for that? Nobody. I think in this case, where people have been critical of the club in the past about contracts and those kinds of things, about players being able to go for free, in this case, Arsenal renewed his contract. He's done really well. And maybe this is the kind of player you need to sell to reinvest in your squad. I'd love to see him get a chance too, but I can see very easily how this situation will end with him going somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's obviously a very highly motivated, ambitious guy. And that's not just he's making noises about wanting to play first team football at Arsenal, but also at the international level, the fact that he's very publicly kind of gone, I'm not playing for the under 21s for England. I'm going to go off and have a conversation with the US national team about whether or not they suit me better.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he sounds like someone who's not going to be satisfied in any circumstances of just sitting around. And Arteta may look at that, knowing full well that you have a 25-man squad and he obviously has a very preferred starting setup at the moment. Is he going to just sort of bow to the demands of a 21-year-old who's, you know, obviously a highly talented player? But I don't think he's going to change that. I think if we were really struggling for goals, maybe there would be a conversation around it, a bit more of a conversation around it. But, you know, Arteta set us the challenge of hitting 90 goals this season. I didn't think that was in any way, shape or possible. Like, or I didn't think it was any way, shape, or possibly, like, the idea that we were going to do that this season, given how many goals we had to make up from previous seasons. But we've hit 72 in the league already. 8 games to go. The rate at which we're scoring, we should do that. I mean, and that is just, that's good training. That is getting players to raise the level across the team, but it's also about understanding how you create chances and making sure you have the right players on the pitch to do that. And
yeah,
we've done it. And you know, my faith is in the manager. And if the manager says I don't need Flo Balogun, we'll take 30 million for him, 40 million, whatever. Fine, I'll live with it. You know, I'll live with it.
Yeah, yeah, me too. I mean, add a sell on, add a buyback, whatever you want to do, but we've long exhorted the club to make the most of the transfer market in terms of selling. We've got to be able to sell well as a club. And, you know, if Balogun generates a lot of money in the way that Joe Willock did, for example, and goes on to have a good career, like you say, you know, that might be a decision we have to make.
We need to start Shakhtar-ing it, though. You know, we need to start putting, you know, the message out there that so-and-so cost 100 million quid.
Yeah, that's, you know,
we've got to sit on that for a while.
Yeah, if Mudrick cost 100 million, Flo Balogun is 370
million pounds. Yeah.
Right, let's do one very quick one before we go. GMAFC on the Discord says, what manager would you like to see come in at Leicester to give them even the slightest chance next weekend? I'm going for Big Sam, getting them to play 9 at the back. But it's not going to be Jesse Marsh. God. We know that.
You need an inspiring figure who would get the Leicester fans super excited.
Bring back Claudio Ranieri.
Ranieri, Gary Lineker.
Gary Lineker as manager of Leicester. I'm not
just
sure.
Standing there.
Yeah.
Depending on what, you know, how many punches Bayern throw this week against Man City, I'm not holding out any hope really of Leicester doing us a favour.
Man City James 26, Madison. Leicester 1.
We just need, you know, Vardy's going to need to be on all of the Red Bull this week to have him up for that. But I mean,
the jumbo cans of Monster.
I just, there's almost no point at this point looking at City and hoping for that, because it just makes you more sad. I watched them against Southampton and it was really tight for a while, and Southampton missed a chance and then City went up the other end and killed it. And it just made me regret the fact that I'd even turned the TV on. So it's almost better just to blank it all out, assume they'll win everything and hope that we do the business at the Etihad somehow.
That's it. Go up a mountain and then, you know, look at your phone when all the texts come through and go, oh my God, Vardy, he scored a consolation goal in Man City's 26-1 win. All right. Look, we better leave it there.
Actually,
go on.
I was just going to say, I did go up a mountain recently and bump into a manager. So maybe if Julian Nagelsmann wants to take over at Leicester, I'll be okay with that.
Well, there you go. He could well mastermind a glorious victory and help them avoid relegation. Who knows? All right, we'll leave it there for now. Andrew, thank you very much for so ably standing in for James.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. I hope, hope James is doing all right. I haven't spoken to him in a while. But,
little rocky.
Big deal.
Get the headphones on, listening
great
to
it. Story.
Sure is. All right. For you guys, thank you very much as always for being here. We'll have some stuff for you on Patreon this week as well. Schedule is a bit all over the place. I will explain on the blog and on the podcasts that we get out to you. For now, take it easy and we will catch you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.